History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative before it's too late to ask a few questions and then be ready to have our perspective develop as we patiently listen for memories that have, in many cases, been buried for decades to emerge from those shadows again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we find that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is Memorial Day weekend, and I'm pretty sure if you're a regular listener to this program, you know quite well the difference between Veterans Day and Memorial Day. Maybe the simplest way of differentiating it is to say that Veterans Day, every November, is when we recognize that all gave some. And Memorial Day, each May, is when we remember that some gave all. Well over a million Americans dating back to the War for Independence have given their lives for the cause of freedom. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, you've heard many a veteran in the process of sharing his or her own story share memories of the Gold Star heroes who never had the privilege of coming home. We're going to focus on some of those stories today, but first I want to remind you about an ongoing effort I've mentioned before on this program, Stories Behind the Stars. It's an effort to build a database to tell the story of every single American who died while serving in World War II. If you go to storiesbehindthestars.org, you can see some of those stories that have already been completed, and you can also learn how to volunteer to help bring that grassroots effort to completion. The organizers hope to have every one of those stories of the World War II fallen done by the 80th anniversary of the end of the war in 2025. On Monday, the official Memorial Day holiday, there will be a ceremony at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., featuring a Merchant Marine veteran. Statistically, the Merchant Marine carried with it a greater chance of being killed in action than the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, or Army Air Corps. 1 in 26 merchant seamen paid the ultimate price, and because it wasn't officially part of the armed forces at the time, the families of the fallen did not receive the same benefits as someone from the other branches. The merchant mariners of World War II are the latest recipients of the Congressional Gold Medal. An official ceremony was held this month in Washington, and I have a link to that for you at hometownheroesradio.com. One merchant marine veteran we had the privilege of meeting here on Hometown Heroes owed his surname to one of the war's Gold Star heroes, a shipmate of his who was killed 77 years ago this weekend on May 28, 1945. I think it'll all come into view for you as we listen to the memories of Leonard Blake, orphaned as an infant, adopted by an LAPD officer who later abandoned the family. Leonard started trying to join the war effort when he was just 14. A year and a half later, he finally got his wish.
I saw a sign that said, "Join the United States Maritime Service. Serve your country." It was on 6th and Hill Street, and I went into the recruiting office, and he said, "Let me see your birth certificate." I said, "Well, here I go again," because I was only 15 years old, and you had to be 16 and a half for the maritime school. And he took my birth certificate, and he looked at it, and he said, "Yep, you're 16 and a half," just like that. I was 15, so that's when I got in the United States Maritime Service.
Did you know how dangerous that job could be?
Not really. I just wanted to get into the war effort. I was a hot shell man on a 3-inch 50 forward on the Marianne Livermore.
But that wasn't your first ship.
No.
That wasn't your first ship.
My first ship was the SS John Constantine. I made mistakes all the way along. When we pulled into New York Harbor, after we were the only ship that made it. We had three ships leave San Pedro, and they were loaded with 2,700 ton of bombs on each one of them. And we were the only ship that got through to Calcutta with our bomb load.
What happened to the others?
They got sunk. We were the only ship that made it.
Now, when you say that, does that mean you witnessed that? You saw them sinking?
No, I saw I was on bow watch one night, and I saw a flash of light just completely light up the sky. We were one day apart, three ships that were one day apart as we left. And I saw the sky light up, and I knew it was one of the ships.
Hmm.
But then I'd heard afterwards that they were the other one had gone to, we were in Australia, and from there we were over to India. And,
well, when you see that flash of light, now, and as I understand it, your three ships, one day apart, but following the same course to India. So you see that flash of light, you put two and two together, you know what's happening.
Yeah, we know.
And you guys are going to be passing through those same waters.
Yeah.
Does that make you wonder what's going to happen to you?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, you're waiting for them.
Did anybody on the ship know how young you really were?
I don't think so. Because the captain on the first ship I was on, he and the first mate called me in when we reached New York Harbor and wanted me to go to officer's training school. And I was only 16. I said, no, Captain, I want to go to sea. So that's when I got off that ship and went over to the Marianne Livermore. And when I got back down to, you know, San Pedro, that was my last ship.
Did anybody on the ship know how young you really were?
I don't think so. Because the captain on the first ship I was on, he and the first mate called me in when we reached New York Harbor and wanted me to go to officer's training school. And I was only 16. I said, no, Captain, I want to go to sea. So that's when I got off that ship and went over to the Marianne Livermore. They told me that I'd never walk again when I got wounded. I shattered both bones and both legs. And doctor said I had so many wounds I couldn't close all of them. And a field surgeon, he said, we've got to take your legs off, son. And I said, no. You just roll me over there and let me die because I don't want to lose my legs. He thought a minute. He said, we'll see what we can do. And he promised that he wouldn't take my legs off. They put me to sleep, and I woke up, and I had casts on up to here all the way down my legs, and my wounds were all somewhat sealed up. He asked me, how am I doing? And I said, I worked in a hospital one time, I said, when I was 13, I think. And I said, I never saw red casts before. And he laughed, and he said, you had so many wounds, we couldn't close all of them. Nine surgeons worked on me from Okinawa back all the way to the United States. And every one of them told me I'd never walk again. And I asked to get out of the hospital, and the doctor said, if you can get on crutches, I'll let you go. Because the Blakes came to see me, and their son was one of the boys killed on the ship. They wanted me to come and live with them. And I told them, if I can get out of the hospital, I'll come live with you. Finally, the doctor let me go. I had got the crutches, and I got it. One of the nurses took me to the train station, sent me back, and I went to live with the Blakes. They took me in, and they were like a mother and father to me. And they finally adopted me. Yeah, I was in my forecastle at the time the plane hit us, and the armor-piercing bomb came through below decks and killed the captain and the first mate and landed next to me and exploded.
Well, and even before that, had you guys dealt with kamikazes there at Okinawa?
Yeah, we were there for 20 days.
So,
and they'd come in every day. The kamikazes would come in, and they'd be hitting the ships and skipping off the water when they'd blow them up.
So you'd seen all this with your own eyes.
Uh-huh.
Did you think it was going to happen to your ship?
Well, there was always that chance.
Mm-hmm.
And we always thought we got to our gun station as quickly as we could, you know. On this one, I was down in my forecastle. I heard the plane hit. Then the bomb, when it got to me, I was on my feet. I was headed for the door, and the bomb exploded about 10 feet away from me, I guess, and killed the kid next to me. Blew me through the door into the passageway and my head first into the bulkhead. This top of my head is like a road map where I hit the bulkhead. And I woke up in a passageway sitting there in a pool of blood. And I couldn't figure out what the heck happened. I thought I was dying. I started making promises. I said, if you let me live, I'll never, and I couldn't think of anything I'd ever done because I never smoked or drank. And I made the promise that I'd never smoke or drink. And I just went from there on.
And as you described that, how close the bomb landed to you, what happened to others who were there?
It killed a kid next to me, and 11 were killed from the bomb blast and from the plane hitting the topside. 11 dead, 7 were wounded.
And it sounds almost impossible that you did survive.
Yeah.
Did you lose consciousness?
When I hit the bulkhead, I was out, yeah. It blew me through the, there was an escape panel on the door panel, and I was just a few feet from the door and to get into the passageway so I could get to my gun station. When it blew me through it, well, I went head first right into the bulkhead on the other side, and it put me out. I woke up sitting there looking, and I was in a pool of blood, and my legs were hanging there.
Your pants had been blown off.
Yeah, that's all I had. Didn't have a shirt on.
And so you're taking stock of your injuries.
Yeah, I was looking at them.
So your legs, you couldn't control, and the muscles were detached?
They were all torn up. The calf muscle was hanging out and jumping around, and blew off a portion of this foot, my left foot, and then my right foot had a great big hole on the top of my foot, and my Achilles tendon was severed, and I had all wounds everywhere. I had one I had right here in my chest. And I remember reaching down. It was a piece of metal sticking in me here. And I reached down and I pulled it out and dropped it on the deck.
Right from the center of your chest?
Yeah.
And your eye socket was broken too?
Yeah. Yeah, the socket on this side is busted here. And I don't know what was done on top because they didn't even pay any attention to my head when I got to the field hospital. When they took me off the ship, they put me in a longboat and took me over to another ship. And then put me back on the ship again, or on the longboat. And I was on the boat with the ensign that was in charge of the gun crew on my ship. And he was lying there next to me, and he was crying and apologizing. He says, "I thought it was a kingfisher. I ordered the gun crew not to fire." And I said, "Don't blame yourself for it. That's just something that could happen to everybody." But he was all upset about it.
Because he had thought this is an American plane.
Yeah.
But it turns out it's a Japanese kamikaze.
Yeah.
And your body is shattered.
Yeah, everything. I had wounds everywhere. They said I had so many wounds I couldn't close all of them.
And you must have lost a ton of blood.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were pumping blood into me all the time.
So what were you really thinking? As I try to put myself in your shoes, it's hard to imagine that you could see much of a future for yourself in that condition.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you just think, oh, this is, the end. But you just keep going.
And you mentioned that 11 of your shipmates were killed.
Yeah, and I made a promise to them. I promised them that I'd give them 10 years of my life, each one of them. I don't know how old I'd be, probably 110. But I keep thinking now, with this thing here, the way things are, and my heart's going on me and everything. And I look up and I see him. I said, "You're keeping me here because I made that dumb promise when I was a kid."
Well, let me ask you about that too, because I've talked to a lot of veterans who made promises like that.
Yeah.
And some of them, it was something that came from a real deep-rooted place that they really believed someone was listening when they made that promise. And others, it was a desperate, plea to someone they weren't sure was there or not. Yeah. What about for you? Is that something that you really felt deeply someone was listening to you?
Yeah, I never believed in God or anything before. But all of a sudden somebody was there, and I was thanking them for letting me live and my promises I made.
And those guys who were killed?
Yeah.
How many of them did you know well?
Probably half of them. Some of the Navy kids were around with them, and the kids in the Merchant Marine, I knew them. Bob Blake was one, and T.J. Garner was another. He was the one that was next to me. He was laying next to me on his bunk. I was sitting there in this pool of blood, and I looked over, and here comes Garner through the escape hatch. He's crawling through like this, and he's reaching out to me, and I'm thinking, I can't help him. And he was trying, just like asking for help. And I looked over at him, and he fell forward, and he had a hole in his back about that big.
6 inches or so.
Yeah, and he was dead. But
wow.
It's hard for a 16-year-old kid to go through that.
Boy, it seems impossible for a 16-year-old kid to go through that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Bob Blake, and it sounds like there was a pretty special connection the two of you had.
Yeah, we were buddies, His mom and dad were, he was an only son, too. And so when I didn't have any place to go from the hospital, because the little lady that was my mother at the time, she was being taken care of by relatives, so I had no place to go. And the Blakes took me in and were very, I didn't ask anybody for any help, the government or anybody. After that, when they kicked me out of the hospital, when I went out of the hospital, I had orders to go to a public health service hospital in Los Angeles at the federal building for treatment for my injuries. When I got in there, well, I was on a gurney. Two doctors walked up. I guess they were doctors, and one of them steps back and he says, "I don't have any sympathy for these guys in the Merchant Marine. They're just a bunch of draft dodgers."
Wow.
But I found out later that there were two news reporters, Walter Winchell and another guy, Pegler was the guy's name, were spreading rumors about the Merchant Seamen that weren't true.
And here you'd lied about your age to get in because you wanted to serve.
Yeah.
Well, and so specifically with Blake, while we're on that topic, so Bob Blake, you two were very tight. His family took you in afterwards. But what happened to him that day aboard your ship?
He was killed.
Where was he when it
hit? He was on the gun watch. He was on the 20-millimeter up on topside, and the plane killed him.
And when did you find that out, what had happened to him?
Right afterwards.
Right after you were hurt?
Yeah, I was told by the doctor that, you know, there was 11 that were killed on my ship.
What date was that this happened?
May 28th, 1945. And that's the date I was discharged from the Coast Guard. And then my discharge from the United States Maritime Service was in 1946.
So you're 16 years old.
Yeah.
By any realistic expectation, the injuries you suffered could have or should have been enough to kill you.
Yeah, they would have been.
Your best friend is killed.
Yeah.
And several other of the guys that you'd been spending time with are killed.
Yeah.
What does that do to a 16-year-old's heart and soul and mind?
You just dream about them every night, every day. I still, to this day, I still think of my shipmates. And they said I didn't want anything from the government at all, but they took the veteran status away from us and the GI Bill and everything. They didn't have anything. And in 1988, I found out that they did. They had rectified it, and they were veterans finally. I weighed 160 when I was wounded, and I weighed 90 pounds when I left the hospital.
What did you have to do to get out of the hospital?
I begged the doctor to let me go. He said, "I'll let you go if you can get on crutches." And I said, "Give me the crutches." And I got the crutches, and they finally let me go. And one of the nurses took me to this train station, and I came back to Southern California to the Blakes. They were living off of Western Avenue, and they took me in.
So this is, you know, the family of your best friend who's killed the day you're almost killed.
Yeah.
And they visit you in the hospital, and they say, "We want to adopt you."
Yeah.
How big a difference did that make in your life?
I don't know. They were the nicest people in the world, and I always thought about Bob. I owed it to him.
Bob Blake, one of more than 400,000 Gold Star heroes from World War II, as remembered by his shipmate, who was later adopted by that Gold Star family. A powerful reminder this Memorial Day weekend of the price paid by those who never came home, not to mention the enduring burden carried by those who did. It's time for our first break. When we come back, a man who endured life as a prisoner of war and decades later found a poignant way to honor the members of his air crew who made the ultimate sacrifice. This Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.